It was open. We have a couple of small technical bills that I would like to pass out today. And we will not hear Senate Bill 211 today. The draft came back with some flaws in it that need to be fixed. And so we'll get these two bills out of the way, and then we will hear from the CPAs. So if you'd be so kind to give us a briefing on Senate Bill 80, I will open up a work session on Senate Bill 80.
Okay. Chair Hess, members of the committee, Senate Bill 80 allows property tax statements and related correspondence to be delivered via methods other than traditional mail. There are two amendments. Amendment one allows owners of forest land to request DOR to make this available by means other than traditional mail, whereas amendment two requires DOR to notify owners of timber harvested from small tract forest lands that the return is needed, and then they allow the owner to elect for an alternative method of notification. There are revenue impact statements on both amendments with no revenue impact, and fiscal impact statements on both amendments with minimal fiscal impact.
Okay. Question, Senator Benz?
Probably should not have asked me to move that bill forward since I'm going to be a no on 80.
With the amendments?
You don't come to think of it, we did amend it, didn't we? All right, fine. I'll move it. If I learn later that I shouldn't have, I'll
script, until you. We have a script for us, haven't we?
Good. Dash 2-1.
And I should mention the Department of Revenue is signed off on
-2-1
on both amendments. On the dash twos, we're only going to pass the dash twos.
Just the dash twos. Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendment to Senate Bill 80.
Senator Benz moves the dash twos to Senate Bill 80. Discussion? Seeing none. Objections? Seeing none. Bill's amended.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 80 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Benz moves Senate Bill 80 as amended with the due pass recommendation to the floor of the Oregon State Senate. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, Senate Bill 80 goes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate. With a due pass recommendation, we'll start down at this end in our scientific, sophisticated way of assigning bill carriers, and that puts you at the list. So,
okay.
Are you doing the briefing on Senate Bill 81?
Yes.
Close a work session and open up a work session on Senate Bill 81.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 81 comes from the Department of Revenue, and it changes the due date for the forest products harvest tax and Western and Eastern Oregon small tract severance tax to April 15th. You do have the statements in OLIS. There's no revenue impact and a minimal, no fiscal impact.
Questions?
There are no amendments.
No amendments on this one.
On a motion.
Yes, please.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 81 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Benz moves Senate Bill 81 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? The clerk will call the roll.
Senator Riley?
Aye.
Senator Taylor?
Aye.
Vice Chair Benz?
Aye.
Measure Chair? Aye. Sorry, jumping the gun. Measure carries, and I will be the carrier, and SB 81 goes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate, and I would ask for unanimous consent to return to the work session on Senate Bill 80 for purposes of Senator Taylor casting a vote.
That would be greatly appreciated. Thank you.
Yes. Any objection? Seeing none. Senator Taylor, how do you vote on Senate Bill 80 as amended?
Aye.
Taylor votes aye on Senate Bill 80. Close work session. Okay, it's been kind of a tradition in the Oregon Revenue Committees, House and Senate, to have the CPAs of Oregon come in front of us and talk about taxes and federal changes and state changes. And so we're honored to have them take the time out to do that, along with putting together the legislative guide. So Gary and Heather, you want to join us here? Welcome.
Thank you.
Now, this, instead of handing out the booklet, we have it on OLIS. I understand they have a 103 slide PowerPoint here, but they're only going to do 18 slides. So, not that we don't want all 118, but thank you. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Senator Haas and Vice Chair Benson and members of the Senate Committee. For the record, I'm Heather Jackson. I'm a member of the Oregon Society of CPAs and the Taxation Committee. I'm a certified public accountant practicing in Portland, Oregon. I appreciate the opportunity to participate in today's hearing. On behalf of over 4,400 members of the OSCPA, I respectfully testify to the Reconnect and Federal Legislative Analysis.
Hi, good afternoon, Chair Haas and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Gary Holcomb. I'm a member of the Oregon Society CPAs CPAs Taxation Committee. I'm a certified public accountant in public practice in Portland.
Alrighty, as you know, our book is very long this year, and we are not covering everything in it. We are gonna highlight the items that are most important or we feel are most important to you guys. Our committee has attempted to break down the federal law into five recommendations, similar to the prior years. As a reminder, our primary objective is to be a technical resource to the legislature, and secondly, to promote taxpayer compliance by striving to keep Oregon's tax law tied to the IRS code. Oregon's permanently connected only applies to the definition of taxable income. Oregon has been permanently connected to the federal taxable income since January 1 of 2011. We support rolling Reconnect, whether the tax implications to the taxpayers is increased or decreased. One exemption to this connection is the deduction related to pass-through income under IRC 199A, Heather, like the domestic production activities deduction in the prior years.
Heather, I'm going to ask you to speak up just a little bit, okay?
Oh, sorry. Let's see here. One exemption does not have a large impact to taxpayer compliance, but many exemptions are different. Connection dates have an impact to taxpayer compliance, subsequently causing the Oregon to issue notices and perform audits.
So we'd like to give you just a couple of examples about why the committee feels that Reconnect is very important and being connected in order to achieve that compliance that Heather mentioned. If we take, for example, a bill that the federal Congress is considering now on tax extenders, if we take, for example, assume that is passed May 15th and it becomes effective May 15th, 2019, typically those bills then would be retroactively effective to January 1 of 19. So for most taxpayers, calendar year 19 tax year. Oregon, if Oregon chose to disconnect permanently from all these provisions, then Oregon would not be connected for 19. In the most likely scenario would be is when you reconvene in January and you debate next session in your January 2020 session. That is the earliest you could consider that provision, whether it's, you know, favorable or unfavorable for taxpayers, and they would not have the benefit of that for their 2019 year, or they wouldn't know the Oregon policy for that and be able to make the correct business or personal decisions for some of those provisions. So being disconnected can have an impact like that. Another impact that we often see, and as you've connected and reconnected from provisions before, have been things like depreciation and automatic expensing. So that can create a number of complications for taxpayers. If you had a taxpayer with 100 assets in their business, they'll have different bases for those depreciations for Oregon versus federal. They have to track not only those 100, they have to track all the additions and disposals they have until all those assets are gone. And what this can do then is you have a federal basis of depreciation, you can have a book basis, financial statement basis of depreciation, and if every state was like Oregon, you could have 50 different states also on that, on a different depreciation method. So theoretically, you could have 53 different books and records. So that just creates a lot of complications for taxpayers, and we believe would decrease compliance in situations like that.
Spend a second on this, because we've spent a lot of time on this issue in this committee. And sometimes there are policies that the legislature disagrees with. They're not the accounting methods per se, they're not the expensing and those things, but they're just a policy. One that's come up recently was gambling losses. We lost a deduction for student loans. And so at what point do we err on the side of ease for accountants versus good policy for Oregonians?
Yeah, and I think that's not our—that's not what we're here to answer today. Today, I think we're here to be more educational. I don't think it's ease of accountancy, in my opinion. I think it's more of ease of taxpayer compliance, whether you're using an accountant or not.
Yes, Senator Benz.
And I recalled during our discussions last week, I recalled exactly this back and forth a number of years ago. And what I'm most interested in is that the taxpayer not knowing in mid-year what to do, because they wouldn't know for sure what we were going to do until 6 months later or whenever the federal government acted.
Right.
And that was a big deal back then. But I think the bigger deal, because my cousin's a CPA and whined about it all the time, incessantly, were the two, having to keep two sets of books, the two depreciation schedules, and that was a huge pain in the neck, at least according to him. Does that fall into the CPA pain in the neck, or is that somehow translated also into a taxpayer problem?
Heather, maybe you can go too, but I think it's both. I think it's both. The reason that some taxpayers are using CPAs is because of the complication is why they use that. Some people choose to do their own. So whether you use a CPA or not, it's still the same issue that you're going to be facing, if I'm understanding your question. But it is a complication. I think, as Heather said, with like one disconnect, most people can handle that, right? It's when you're connected and how many are those and how do you keep track of all of those?
A follow-up? To the chair's point, though, his point is we have a choice. We can disconnect and then figure out what to reconnect to one at a time, or we can remain connected and figure out what to disconnect from one at a time.
That's right.
Which one works better? Because they both seem to have difficulties. Because if we choose to remain connected throughout the entire course of the year, and then in 2020 come back in here and go, well, we sure didn't want to be connected to that, and we then blow up the people's expectations that they formed or in the mid-year.
For ease of administration, I think it would be the rolling reconnect versus the other term is static conformity. Hmm. I don't know, Heather.
I would agree.
Thanks.
Senator Ryan.
I'm sorry.
So I want to follow up on that same point, because I don't understand why it's harder for people in the middle of the year to decide what the legislature is going to do if we are opt in as opposed to opt out. It's going to be the same. They're going to go, okay, the legislature is going to come back in 6 months and we don't know what they're going to do in either case.
I think on a rolling reconnect, that you assume that you're going to follow that policy. So if the taxpayer makes a federal decision, and let's again in my example of May of 2019, then on a rolling reconnect, you know Oregon is connected. If it's a static conformity date where you chose, let's just say January 1 of 2019, they would assume for Oregon you were going to be disconnected, but you might want to reconnect. I mean, I see your point that it goes back and forth both ways, but the rolling reconnect is automatic where you know how it's going to be treated for federal guidance purposes.
Let me throw it.
Does it make sense?
Yes, actually, and I know this is why you came here, to be put on the hot spot of this, but most states start their calculation at AGI, and they don't have to deal with a lot of these connection issues.
No, the other.
Because they start at AGI, whereas we're at the federal tax collection, federal tax connection point. Would that be a good way to go, in your opinion? I mean, 41 states do it that way.
Heather, I'll let you, do you want to, from an individual?
From an individual standpoint, as a simplicity, after last year's discussion, I think a lot of people assume we're at AGI anyway, and there was a lot of discussion around that anyway. I'd say if we're going to tie it AGI, then we can tie it AGI. Textbook income to AGI, if it's just that change and we kept with a rolling reconnect, that is far preferable than taking taxable income and then taking away either rolling reconnect or picking and choosing things as we go. If AGI allows us to be rolling reconnect on most everything, I think that's kind of easier to handle from a tax compliance standpoint.
And corporations are different because you're not starting with the definition of AGI. Right.
Senator Benz? Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the one of the questions was how much more will the taxpayer have to pay for tax assistance in the event that we choose to disconnect? Is this going to complicate matters across the board, or is it, it sticks in my mind that because you have to maintain dueling depreciation schedules and other challenges, that the cost of your work goes up. But I want to say back in, was it 2010 and 2011? We did this and did do quite a lot of response, and that's why we changed back. Am I remembering correctly that CPAs quickly reduced their fees dramatically after there was a reconnect?
Well, some of it is they don't, it's perception. They don't see all the changes. They don't see our benefit at times for all the changes when we have a disconnect. They just assume it's there and we know it. So when we had the initial one, I think it was 9 or 10 when we disconnected for depreciation, the first year was all about our fees are going up because of the additional compliance, blah, 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 and it was a big to-do. And then when the compliance went away, it was like, okay, now we don't have to do that. So it's a lot more work on our side with fees because we have to educate people that there is a difference. I mean, some of our taxpayers aren't totally up on tax law and don't know that there's differences in compliance changes. So even just having to keep them informed of that and then our fees changing from that also.
And we're still dealing with the ramifications of the 10 and 11 disconnect because there's assets that did take bonus or did not take bonus at different rates, and you're still having those assets roll through your system like when you dispose of them and catching up on those. That's still happening today.
But that was one of those choices, though, that when we were talking about this very thing the other day, that we couldn't afford to do that, whereas the federal government could because they can borrow, and it was just a very practical thing. So. Senator Taylor, did you have
thank you, Chair Hess. I was just curious. Thank you for coming. I really appreciate you taking the time to go through this as we're already stopping you and only on the immediate slide. But yeah, I was just curious regarding the rolling connect, not connect, et cetera. For those who are, for individuals who earn on the lower end, I'll just leave it in the general sense, which is better for somebody in general? Which system works better for that individual? That may be a lower income worker to be, is it better to have a connect or a disconnect on whole? Does it make any?
I don't know that I've really looked that close.
Maybe it doesn't make a difference.
With when we go through some of these provisions, Senator Taylor, I think you'll see later is the reconnect isn't a good thing or a bad thing. There's policy choices the senator has been made, right? So it's not a good thing or a bad thing. It's just a compliance perspective more from that and a taxpayer understanding. So an automatic reconnect allows taxpayers to understand more because there's more federal guidance on that, right? And if you disconnect, Oregon may pick a different depreciation system. So then we would have to educate ourselves and someone else would have to educate themselves. So on a lower income scale, they less likely have those types of issues.
Follow up. But if we were to go with a system where we're always choosing on an individual basis to to disconnect, then we would need to be mindful about those impacts on a one-by-one basis.
That's right.
That's right.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Senator Boquist.
I'm assuming if we get through the rest of the slides, you're going to talk about record keeping, because I'm listening to your still hearing Senator Riley's question about, well, middle of the year, so on and so forth. I'll just give one example that's already been before the committee is if you disallow the federal deduction and now you have to itemize on your state, if you were following the federal law, you wouldn't have kept thousands of receipts, so on and so forth, because your accountant said, well, you're not going to meet this threshold. And now if you've disconnected with that and you now have to itemize all this stuff, just the average taxpayer, low income, is not going to have all this stuff because they assumed that this was going to carry through. And I would assume if you change a policy in mid-stride, anything from depreciation to anything else, once again, it's not just you. You're relying on what the taxpayer, either business or individual, is giving to you. And if they didn't know it changed, they're not going to give you the right information, and they may not even have the records to do so. I mean, I would just point out that I know CPAs have told people with the 12 to 24,000 now, you don't need to keep these records, so on and so forth. And obviously, we have a bill before this committee right now that will change, says we change that on January 1 of 19 and go back to, we would have to use those as deductions and itemize in the future, which means we would be telling them, you don't need the records for this federal, but you now need the records for the state. And I think that record keeping is not just record keeping, if you can cover it when you go through here, not an answer, but cover through here, because then there's also decisions. Do you buy this piece of equipment? Do you make this expense now? Do you make it next year? Do you drop it from your depreciation schedule? Do you sell the assets? That all gets pretty complicated. And hopefully you'll cover it as each one of these as you go through, because you can do anything you want to until you get audited. And the DOR is sitting back there, and as soon as you're audited, now you got to produce all these documents. So,
yes.
I don't think I need an answer. I'm just pointing out that I think it's more complex.
Okay. I'm done grilling you for this slide.
You're on slide one, right?
As in years past, it's the slide right before the first page. It's what our recommendation key means, just as a refresher real quick. A are those provisions that with the rolling reconnect, your Oregon would automatically be connected to those provisions because it ties to federal taxable income. So we've tried to classify those items within A. B are things that aren't tied to taxable income. It may be a federal tax rate. It could be a credit, a penalty provision, things that aren't necessarily tied to taxable income, so they wouldn't necessarily impact Oregon's taxes. The C's we'll spend a few minutes on. There's just a few. Those are changes that if connection is desired, that you will need to make some affirmative changes to in order to connect to the federal code, is what we believe. This year there are no D's, and then Heather will cover quickly the E's, which are just things like excise taxes and something that Oregon doesn't have the equivalent to or doesn't tie to necessarily directly.
Alrighty. So in our presentation, we're going to cover A and C in more detail. In Section A, we will be skipping items that we feel are less important, less critical to you guys. If there's one that we skip, because we will go through page numbers so you'll know where we're at, please stop us and ask questions. So we're not trying to avoid any of them. We're just trying to move along a little faster. Sections B and E will not be covered in detail. We will give some summaries of those. And as Gary said, D is blank. So we're going to go ahead and start on page one with the cash method of accounting, and then the next two topics of accounting for inventories and what's the other one? UNICAP. These are changes from the $1 million average gross receipts up to the $25 million average gross receipts, basically allowing more businesses to be cash bases and not track inventory. That's kind of the highlight of that one.
Okay. The next one we chose to cover was on page four, which are local lobbying expenses. You will see in this one that the 2017 Act eliminated the deduction for lobbying at the local level, so businesses are no longer able to deduct those expenses. And then I am next on page. Sorry?
I'm seven.
Oh, you're seven.
I'm seven.
There you go.
Pages 7 through 12 are the depreciation rules. We have the 100% expensing. We have Section 179. We have the luxury limit limitations. Basically, the 100% expensing started 9/27/17. The phase outs and the luxury limit increases for Section 179 and luxury autos are listed in here. We don't need to cover those. The other thing is farming machinery and equipment was depreciated at 5 years, 1.5 declining balance, so a slower depreciation. They've moved it to being a 5-year asset for machinery and equipment and getting regular depreciation, double declining balance.
So those tried to group all those depreciation things. I think you're fairly familiar with those. So the next one is on page slide 11 that we'll cover. And it's the limitation on business interest. The Act provided that any interest expense that a company may have now is going to be limited. It's the addition of three things. It's any interest income you may have, 30% of adjusted taxable income, plus any floor plan financing. And floor plan financing are used by like car dealers. So those three added together, your business interest expense cannot exceed that amount. So it's basically a way that NOLs and things are going to be reduced because you're not going to be able to deduct as much interest expense. The other one to point out is slide 14 and 15. The entertainment expenses and business entertainment meals, you'll see a number of things in there. I think the most important thing to realize there is that entertainment expenses on their own are no longer deductible. But meals can be deductible if they're provided at that entertainment venue if they're separately stated in price. So if you have a ticket and a meal, you're okay. If you have a ticket that includes a meal, it's no longer deductible. And then there are certain employee benefits like convenience of employer meals that will either be deducted at a lower amount or a higher amount.
Any questions so far? Ready? On to page 19, bottom of page 19. Deductibility of fines and penalties for federal income tax purposes. This one has a variety of questions, but the biggest thing to take away on this one is that there is not a lot of penalties and fines that are deductible for the IRS. This is a very narrow and limited practical use, so it's not widely used.
Okay. The next one is page 20. Which is qualified opportunity zones on the bottom of the page there. Qualified opportunity zones, typically you would think that might be in the credits area, but this is actually because it impacts taxable income and how taxable income is calculated. We put it in Section A. And an opportunity zone, local leaders across the country were able to designate certain areas within their states as an opportunity zone. Once that designation happens, an opportunity fund can be established. And if you have capital gains that you would like to invest into the opportunity zone fund, you're able to invest those into a fund, and there can be basically a deferral until a number of earlier dates, until 2026 or until the property that investment is sold. If the investment's held more than 5 years, the capital gains tax, which you wouldn't care about as much, is reduced by 10%. In 7 years, it's reduced by another number 5. If those are held for 10 years and are longer in that qualified opportunity fund, that can be a permanent deferral and are tax-free.
Senator Benz. Mr. Chair, so if I have this right, I hate to bring the word 1031 up, but you have a capital asset, you sell it, you have a limited period of time to take the money you receive on that sale, and you dump it into the opportunity zone account, and then you have a limited amount of time again to acquire something, start building a building, do something inside the opportunity zone. And then you wait the 10 years and you can wash all the gain through tax-free, and from day one of the original investment.
Your analogy to a Section 1031 exchange is very close. I think the biggest difference in this case is you're not necessarily the builder in that zone, in the zone. So you would make an investment in an opportunity zone fund, and then the fund would do within the zone itself. It would be the one that builds the building or makes the investment, whatever type of investment that is. So you own a share of the fund. You may be a person that owns the whole fund, or you could be a party that owns a piece of it.
Follow up. So it's an aggregation device. You can pile a whole bunch of stuff in it. And then do you have to build something new, or can you buy an existing feature of a within the opportunity zone?
I'm not sure. It was very similar concepts to the new markets tax credits that used to be. It's just a different method to get to a new, similar method to get to a new markets tax credit type credit. But instead of it allowing a credit, they allow this gain deferral.
Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Hass. Can you just explain a little bit more about what the requirements are in order to create the zone, and who creates the zone, and if there is a minimum and a maximum, and then maybe it's a better question for staff to, some conversations about how that's being used here in Oregon that's been brought to my attention, and I would like to learn a little bit more about this, if that's okay with you, Senator Hess.
So I'll answer Senator Taylor and Senator Vince maybe at the same time. Your question, I just was trying to look at the definition of what business property is, and it's tangible property used in a trade or business acquired after 2017. And the original use must commence with the purchase, or property must be substantially improved. So new or substantially improved in order to meet that business property definition, right? So I think, Senator Taylor, what you're asking is that the ozone fund itself, what type of entity that can be, is that?
And what is the zone? What is the definition of create? I understand about the what you just explained about the building of the individual investment, but then there's the zone. Is it all of, in this case, would it be all of Portland? Would it be a certain number of blocks? How does this work?
Yeah, my understanding from that is there were some definitions of what that was, and I don't have those definitions, but then that they had to be, it's maybe the wrong term too, nominated by a local official, usually a state government agency that would then nominate that zone area.
Okay, well, I
but then, and then once that's done, then it's approved from a federal level if it met those criteria. And I think there's approximately 400 across the country that have met that criteria.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Senator Heffney, perhaps we could get some more information on this subject about how they're being used here in Oregon. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, my understanding is that they've already been established, because the cutoff date was way back. And so they're already wherever they are. That's where they're going to be. And then the interesting part to me is because I know how 1031s work, and what ends up happening is there's a premium added to the price of the asset almost always when you're using 1031 dollars, because trying to save that tax dollar. And I wonder if there were any protections put into this to avoid the same kind of inflation that goes on, because it's government money that's being used in part to acquire whatever that new asset is, or add to the, I hate to use the word winery, but I'm going to over here, someone could go to an existing, if it was within an opportunity zone, and add on a new wing. And then the question would be, how much did they pay for it using those new dollars? Is there any oversight on that? Because you're basically
those things that I mentioned, Senator Benz, like the substantial improvement, right? It's got to meet those definitions.
Yeah,
I don't
meet
know.
Those
I mean, I know that there's certain other protections, certain they were calling them sin businesses, casinos, massage parlors, certain things that you could not qualify in as a proper ozone investment.
Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Hess. Well, thank goodness for that. But however, I'm like, glad to see we haven't gone down that path. But however, I guess the reason I'm asking these questions is I want to learn more about whether or not these zones, when they were created, what the criteria was at the time, what has changed since then, and whether or not they're needed at this point. In other words, would the development occur if we did not have it? So then I don't know the answer to that. So that's what I'm trying to understand more about.
Understood. And it falls again into that category where it's a pretty significant policy, and I don't know if it's good or bad, but it wasn't created by anybody in Oregon.
That's correct.
Did you have something?
Is there 400 in Oregon or 400 nationwide?
Nationwide.
Can't be that many in Oregon, then.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I was just going to add, so Business Oregon and with the governor as well, so the governor was the one that declared the zones, and there is actually a map that's up on the website, but we can provide some background information if that'd be helpful, of where these zones...
Yeah, I'm just trying to learn.
Florida did this. I feel warm and fuzzy now. I might be in your camp now.
Senator Benz, there were issues similar to the 1031 exchange that your committees had to deal with in the past, such as if you exchange an Oregon property for a non-Oregon property, and how does that, you know, how is that gain then tracked? So there will be things for you to consider on this.
Pretty much.
Thank you. That's one zone.
No, these are all the different zones throughout the state.
But there are 400 in the country, and how many are there?
More than our fair share, it looks like.
Yeah, we can definitely get the numbers.
I just want to learn more about it. Thank you.
I just pointed out there's only blue blots on that map.
Were they eight?
Polk County.
That wouldn't surprise me at all. I'm back in.
All right. So. Now we'll go on to something even easier. So if we flip to the next topic, it was page 30. And you partially dealt with this last year to some extent. And there are several other pages, 37 in here, that deals with this as well. But the moniker that you're hearing is the guilty FITI provisions. So this mostly revolves around the international. One of the biggest changes from a corporate tax perspective in the budget package for 17 was the change from a worldwide system to a territorial system in the U.S. And so these provisions fully, the provision you dealt with last year was 965, which we'll talk about, which was the actual repatriation of things that had been deferred offshore. Now that you are on a permanent deferral, now that we're on a permanent territorial system, you have to deal with how that income from around the world is subject to U.S. tax. So there is an increase. If you stay connected to it, there will be an increase in income in Oregon through what's called GILTI, global intangible low taxed income. So in countries that may have a lower rate than the U.S. rate, from a very simplistic, the calculations are very complicated, that income will come back into the U.S. and be subject to U.S. tax. Along with the GILTI inclusion, you're also getting what's called a FDII, a foreign deferred intangible income, which may be kept offshore, which is maybe taxed in the U.S. Through other means. So you're getting a deduction for income you earn here on that foreign deferred income. You're also getting a GILTI deduction for when the actual cash is brought back. So you've earned this income. You may or not have dividended out, right? You may have kept it in Germany to keep your German business going. Once they dividend that back, then there will be a GILTI deduction as well for certain pieces of that if it's already been previously subject to tax. And so there's a lot of machinations with foreign tax credits and other provisions within this, but that's the basic, is trying to now equalize the system in 2018 to this territorial. Enough for now. Okay.
Yeah, thank you. So somewhere I read that the amount of repatriation that we anticipated isn't happening. Maybe about a third of what had been hoped would be coming back this direction. Was this done in anticipation of more than that coming in, or did it have anything to do with the repatriation?
It had nothing to do with the repatriation. The repatriation was any income before these provisions were adopted. So basically 2018 and before, it was any income associated with that that you had kept offshore or hadn't been taxed in the U.S., that all was, you know, whether it came back as cash or whether whatever it was subject to tax. And then this is to get you going to forward 18 and forward. So 967 was kind of a retroactive look. This is the prospective look.
Alrighty. On to pages 45 through 50, these are the Schedule A itemized deduction changes. Potentially fewer people will be itemizing at the federal level due to the higher standard deductions that have been granted, but many people will still be itemizing in Oregon. I do have to say many of my taxpayers are surprised when I ask them for their stuff. Oh, wait, I'm itemizing. So it is an issue for Oregon. So on page 45, we'll start with the Schedule A miscellaneous itemized deductions, which is the items that are subject to the 2% phase out. These are usually your tax prep fees, your investment fees, union dues, the employee unreimbursed expenses. So a lot of the industries like mortgage industry, nurses, doctors, to some degree real estate agents, they're union workers. They are paying for things out of their own pocket because their employer doesn't pay it, and they used to deduct it on their federal return, and now they're not going to. Although, if they were taking the miscellaneous itemized deductions, they may or may not have gotten the deduction anyway because there was AMT. So whether the taxpayer knew they were or were not deducting it, they knew they saw it on the return.
So except for cases, teachers who spend out of their own pocket can no longer deduct.
Say that again.
Teachers who, you know, buy paper, pencils out of their own pocket can no longer use that as a deduction.
That's a good example as any, right? Not going to beat up teachers, but on the AMT side, I mean, what would be, it's a 2% threshold, right? So say a teacher, at what point on a, you guys pick a number, at what point does it becomes immaterial? Because what your point was, accountant, was that even though they had it listed, they thought they were getting it because of the AMT, they weren't really getting it anyway. So what's sort of the threshold? If you want to use a different one other than a teacher, make one up. Sort of give us an example of what you're saying.
So for an example is, and I'm going to start with last year's, they got to deduct their state income taxes, their real estate taxes, their medical expenses, if they got above 7.5% or 10%, and then you had your miscellaneous itemized deductions above 2%. So all those items made it to Schedule A and are deductible. When you got over to AMT, your state taxes were an add back. So state taxes, your miscellaneous itemized deductions, and medical were all add backs to AMT. So people would hit AMT and those deductions then are less valuable.
Can you give us, helpful to give us an example, say, person's making $50,000. You see what we're trying to drive at here? Looking for something.
Yeah, the math would be
atrocious
on the spot. It would. I think that's a tough asker today, to be honest.
I understand the question, though, right? Because it's easy to say, well, the teacher didn't get to deduct this, but then, or the cab driver didn't get to deduct it, or whomever it is here, right? And then it turns out it isn't there, because, I mean, my return is like the full employment for you people. And I don't make that much money. It's still 100 friggin' pages, okay? So it's like, okay, you add it in, you add it out, so on and so forth. And DOR back there can audit and ask me all the questions. And one, I have got a clue what it says. So that's why I didn't have to pay you guys to do it. But I think that's a lot of these itemized things, a lot of these complicated ones, you know, it's in here, it's out there, and trying to figure out the value of whether it's worth disconnecting by the time you get done or not.
Well, the difference is for you guys, the AMT isn't there for the add back. So Oregon doesn't have the same AMT structure that the IRS does. So what they're being disallowed at the federal level is different than at Oregon if you look at the itemized deductions.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
What I think, can I ask
for, I'm sorry.
Senator Boquist.
So I think you mean these are being phased out in the federal level, right? and you have this larger lump sum. And then in theory, if we disconnect it and now you have to itemize, right? We're back where I was talking about earlier in the hearing where they weren't keeping all of these records anymore. Now they're going to need them for the state because they have to now have the records for the state because you're adding back what was deducted at the state, at the federal level. So all of these items that are on here, we may or may not connect or disconnect with. Am I making sense?
Well, we just,
I think the addition
comment would be is that these, you're not disconnecting from these any longer because they don't exist. I mean, you are disconnected already because they just don't exist for federal purposes. You'd have to, if you wanted to have one of these provisions that were taken away, you'd have to affirmatively make that.
And we have a bill to do that. That's what my point is. We have a bill that would eliminate this and you would add it back and then you'd have to do some sort of, we'd have to have some sort of deduction schedule.
That's not a connection versus
a disconnection.
No, that's true. It's an add back, but before 2017, the state provided deductions for teachers if they bought extra supplies.
Right.
And now that's been eliminated. So if we wanted to go back to help teachers, we'd have to add it back in.
That's correct.
And the one that's next on your list is the exact same story, except college tuition.
So one of the, if we keep going through, the next is the limitation, itemized deductions. This is the PEAS limitation, where if you hit certain income levels, your itemized deductions were yet again reduced, which was the PEAS limitation. That's been suspended as well. The mortgage interest rate on page 46 is the mortgage interest deduction. If you have a loan incurred after 12/15 of 17 is now limited to 750,000 of acquisition indebtedness. All the grandfathered loans are still at $1 million. Then next is the state and local tax deduction, which is the SALT deduction for the $10,000 for your income taxes and real estate taxes. The next one on page 47, this one we just thought we would bring to your attention is the elimination of living deduction for members of Congress. That is changed effective 2018. So for the living expenses for being away from the home, those are no longer being deducted. Charitable contributions, the limitation was 50% of AGI and anything above that was carried forward. Now the limitation is 60% of AGI, with the rest, if you did more than that, then it was carried forward. The 80% deduction for contributions to universities' athletic funds is no longer deductible. So if you donated and you got a statement from the university for the athletic fund donation, it usually said 80% of this was tax deductible. It is now non-deductible.
Senator Boquist?
It's when you mentioned the congressional deduction, that's just purely federal congressional, right?
So there are five of them in the state.
I was actually looking after you because I don't get deducted. I was just wanting to make sure they weren't saying, no, it applies to the legislature. So you and I doesn't affect, but there are at least two members here that. If it includes legislatures, it would impact.
Oh, it does.
I'm looking out for you.
Yeah, right.
If I am. And Senator Benz. But
okay,
you
know.
On to page 48, the personal casualty loss deduction. This is for, it actually went below the 2% on Schedule A. This is now only applies to federally declared disaster areas. So all the stuff we had going on in Oregon over the last year doesn't count for this deduction anymore because as far as I remember, none of them were federally declared disaster areas. So the next one is,
I'll check on that, but I don't think you're correct.
Okay.
I think all of the disaster areas, including the fires, were filed with FEMA and were designated federal. So I would assume that the law applies to non-federal, but generally speaking in Oregon, just so nobody starts ringing our phone off here, is that we apply to the state or the federal government if FEMA declares it a federal disaster.
The what?
I will check on that, but I just want to make sure that, because I can hear the forestry people ringing off our phone right now.
The next one is the medical expense deduction, the deductibility of medical expenses of 7.5% above AGI, and there's no more of the alternative minimum tax preference, so it's not subject to Altman tax if you get the deduction. Then on page 49, any questions on that itemized? We're moving off of itemized. Okay. Moving on to the alimony payments on page 49, divorce decrees, separation agreements, and certain modifications entered into after 2018. The deduction is no longer there. The income's no longer there. All the divorce decrees prior to that are grandfathered in. So, and then the last one on page 49 is the moving expense deduction. As of 1/1/18, the moving expenses are no longer deductible unless you're in military. Although they did make a caveat for people who moved in 17 and the employer reimbursed in the first part of 18, that is also non-taxable.
So we're done with what we were going to cover in Section A, unless there's any other questions or comments in A. All right. B is another very large section, which we won't be covering. So when you look at B, if you remember again what I had said about what Bs are, these are things you'll see on the first couple of pages, the corporate tax rate. There's some credits, things that Oregon doesn't need to do anything to, or that wouldn't impact Oregon as far as the definition of tying to federal taxable income. So we'll get on to Cs, and those are the things that the OSCPA would recommend taking a look at from a conformity perspective.
All right, excuse me. Section C, or Recommendation C, starts on page 80 with the pass-through tax treatment. The everything that's in black is the original act. Everything at the end of this page is on page 83, I think it is, starting 82 and 83. Everything in red, actually, throughout this whole booklet has been updated for the changes that have happened since the act was originally enacted. The biggest thing to call out on this one is on page 83, we made a note that Oregon has disconnected from this IRC Section 199 in Senate Bill 1528. So unless there's anything anyone wanted to cover, we're just bringing it up as a reminder that this was dealt with last year.
More to follow. You're going to win or I'm going to win, and then we'll get an appeal. So one of the two of us wins.
I'll move
I'll
on then to
champagne with you.
The next two, the first one on page 84 is dealing with some of these dividends. And again, if you refer back to my discussion on the FDII and GILTI and the territorial system, there are new types of dividends. And they can be called 951A Cap A and 245 Cap A. And there were old provisions that were called 245 little a. And a lot of people are debating whether, and those are called subpart F income and dividends, and there's debate on whether those are fit within the definitions of Oregon, what the dividends received deduction allows. So our recommendation is for the legislature to take a look at those and to make sure that you're providing some consistent treatment along with those new federal definitions, because there just wasn't anything analogous in Oregon law. And this is similar to what's happening in every state across the country.
Can we do it in English, okay? So we can understand what he just said.
I won't go more technical than that then at this point. Similar to the pass-through entity that Heather just mentioned, that treatment of deferred income is the 965, and you did address that Senate Bill 1529 last year, so I think that those provisions are taken care of, but again, you had to proactively do something, so that's why we put it in this section.
Last but not least in this section is the consolidation of education savings rules on page 87. This is the 529 plans that the IRS has allowed up to $10,000 for elementary and secondary school expenses to be paid from the 529. Here in Oregon, you've accepted that and have now, if the person deducted it originally, it is taxable income on the Oregon return. So we were just leaving it here because there was action already done. Any questions on section C? Wonderful. As a reminder, section D is blank, and section E, this section has acts that are in the tax code but do not impact most tax law. Most of these items are excise tax on various items like aircraft, tax-exempt organizations and universities, beer, wine, sparkling wines, and distilled spirits. At the top, we noted that there is an asterisk. Potentially, there are no asterisks in this section. Nothing was worthy of that.
Question, Senator Boakley.
Can you answer? Okay. Wheel of Fortune here. Al's going to love this one. The nonprofits, understanding, Senator or Representative Fahey and I looked at this last time around, and the new tax code supposedly has an excise tax on salaries above $1 million for nonprofits. Is that in one of these things here?
Yes. Just one second.
You said this is the nonprofit section?
Yes, it is.
I believe it's a 21% excise tax above.
It is on page 88 and 89. It is a 21% tax.
And it's on nonprofit salaries above $1 million paid by nonprofits.
Compensation of in excess.
Excess.
Compensation.
Personal compensation. Yep.
So there can be a number of things that are included within taxable compensation more than just salary.
Thank you.
There's some categories here I feel I need to ask you about, like five categories on beer. You know, it looks like they lowered taxes on beer.
Yes.
I've never seen anything on this.
Beer distributors and beer people are going to tell us that. You didn't get a thank you card, right? How much did they lower?
From $18 to $16 per barrel.
But only on a low, the first piece of production.
Yeah, and then it goes up after if you're more than 6 million barrels. And then there's a tax rate on small barrels. And there's a transfer of beer in bond.
Yes. I guess we should have gone in more detail in this section.
So the beer lobby's pretty strong at the U.S. Capitol.
There's actually a bill by Oregon senior senator to extend those reductions. Not a few more years.
To extend the reductions?
Yes, because they right now they're through January 1st.
So we know that our legislative officials drink beer, too, back there.
No comment whether they're doing that.
I just want, when we get to the beer tax, we can have this discussion.
Wine, alcohol, sparkling wines, distilled spirits.
It's a wonder they get anything done.
Okay.
I didn't know they did.
Do you have any questions for Heather and Gary?
Right. Some good, some bad, obviously. Right.
Really appreciate you walking us through. I think we have Doug Henning signed up. Doug, want to come up here? Testify? Good afternoon. You want to talk about the beer tax cut?
Okay. That would certainly help me, help things, but I was really here to talk about 211, and I think that you had delayed 211, but yeah, I'd be happy to talk about anything you'd By the way, my name is Douglas Haney. I'm a CPA, recently retired in May 31 of 2017. I was a CPA for and still am a CPA for 40 years, and a partner in a CPA firm in downtown Portland.
Okay. Well, we put off the public hearing on 211. I'm sorry.
No problem.
Okay. All right. I think Revenue Committee members find this weirdly entertaining when you walk us through this, so we appreciate that. And so thank you. Thank you all. We'll catch up with you down the road.
Sure. I'll be here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything else? Gentlemen and lady, before we close. Kyle? Okay. We will adjourn.